Good afternoon from the University of Southern California, and welcome to From Where We Are from Annenberg Radio News for October 15th, 2015. I'm Carla Javier. But first, a news update with Sebastian Vega.
A free four-day medical clinic for Angelenos opened today. Caitlin Plummer has the story.
Los Angeles nonprofit Care Harbor is holding its fifth annual free health clinic at the Los Angeles Memorial Sports Arena. The clinic is staffed with volunteer doctors and dentists who will be examining and treating Angelenos until Sunday. Robert Rumler Jr. went to the clinic 2 years ago to get his vision checked out and finally got prescription glasses.
Another thing I didn't have money for, so I was couldn't afford them, so I didn't have them and went years without them. So
this year, he's here for dental cleaning.
It's a great opportunity for people that need it that don't have medical or insurance or help.
Cliff Brothauer, a dental assistant volunteering at the clinic, says around 450 patients this year are coming in for just dental work. He says the clinic is important to show communal support.
I think it shows the community that not only the community cares, but just the whole state of California cares.
Last year, the clinic served more than 3,000 patients over 4 days. Caitlin Plummer, Annenberg Radio News.
An investigation by the LA Times shows the Los Angeles Police Department underreported serious crimes, including violent assaults, for 8 years. Samira Jordan has the story.
The LA Times investigation found that the LAPD characterized 14,000 serious assaults, like stabbings, beatings, and choking, as simple assault. If these crimes had been correctly classified, violent crime would have been 7% higher between 2005 and 2012, and 16% higher for serious assault. One of the authors, Ben Poston, says human error was part of the problem.
Their computer system is set up in a way that sort of allows them to underreport crime and just get things wrong. And then there's kind of the touchier subject of, you know, pressure to downgrade or manipulate crime numbers.
Despite the apparently skewed statistics, Poston says serious crime rates fell.
They've made thousands of mistakes in, say, the past decade, but they're not enough to alter the trajectory of the crime rate or the downward, you know, crime trend.
The LAPD declined to comment. Samira Jordan, Annenberg Radio News.
Support is increasing for solar energy, an environmentally friendly alternative to traditional energy. Brianna Feldot has more.
Members of Environment California and students from the California Public Interest Research Group held a news conference this morning in Culver City encouraging the use of solar panels. Councilwoman Megan Solly-Wells stood in support of the solar energy effort.
Culver City has been leading in solar for many years, and we don't want our efforts to be undermined by basically moneyed interests who would like us to stick to fossil fuels.
She said solar energy will improve the environment, which in turn will benefit the community. The California Public Utilities Commission unanimously voted this summer to lower rates of compensation given to solar power users. By lowering rates of compensation for solar users, CPUC is making solar less affordable and therefore less people are tempted to switch. Brianna Feldot, Annenberg Radio News.
Millions of Southern California residents took part in the Great California Shakeout today, a wide-scale earthquake preparedness drill. Participants dropped, took cover under a desk, and held on for 60 seconds to practice earthquake safety. About 10.4 million people registered for the drill. In the wake of the Sarkisian drama, students gather in support of the SC football team. Thibaut Clarice gives us the details.
A USC senior organized a student rally today in support of the Trojan football team as it prepares for one of its most important games of the season against Notre Dame. With the team facing staff changes, morale is low for athletes and scholars alike. Jackson Dahl, the organizer, says that he wants to remind the players that they have the full support of the student body.
It's been a rough week, as you know, and we wanted to do something, just a little small thing that would be special to them. Hopefully there's a decent turnout. I think it's more about kind of the intent and showing the players that, hey, we're students and we care about you guys and we're here to support you guys.
Clay Helton, the new head coach, expressed his gratitude for the Trojan family in a press conference after the rally.
To have these legends come out to support us, as well as our own students come out and be a part of this practice, it speaks volumes to what we represent.
The game will take place this Saturday at Notre Dame. Thibaut Clarice-Gauthier, Annenberg Radio News.
The LA Dodgers need a win tonight to keep their championship hopes alive. They face the New York Mets in about an hour in the fifth game of the National League Division Series. The game is sold out, and the winner of tonight's matchup will play the Chicago Cubs Saturday in the National League Championships. I'm Sebastian Vega, and it's 5 minutes after the hour.
Released a report today about the risks of dietary and natural supplements. These vitamins and supplements are not subject to the same FDA regulations and standards as prescription drugs and can lead to dangerous health problems when mixed with drugs and alcohol. NBA star Lamar Odom was found unconscious earlier this week at a Nevada brothel after reportedly overdosing on cocaine and a natural sexual enhancement drug. Maria Cavasuto looks into the dangers of these natural substances.
A report published today in the New England Journal of Medicine found that 23,000 people a year have to go to the ER because of problems with supplements and vitamins. Dennis Hoff, owner of the Love Ranch where Odom was found, told NBC that Odom had taken herbal Viagra.
In general, with a lot of these herbal supplements, they're not regulated the same way prescription drugs are.
Sam Manzuri, pharmacist and owner of Eddie's Pharmacy in West Hollywood, said consumers need to be aware of what they put in their body.
A lot of these herbal supplements and sort of the fillers and things that they put in to these herbal medications often have drug interactions, often affect the metabolism of other medications, of other substances that someone may ingest. Viagra itself is a vasodilator, which means it opens up your blood vessels, arteries, and veins, and that can open you up to a whole host of issues, whether it be, a sharp decrease in blood pressure, and that's why you're not allowed to take nitrates with it.
Associate professor of USC School of Pharmacy, James Adams, includes priapism among problems with taking supplements that contain the active ingredient sildenafil.
That the penis becomes erect too long. After 4 hours of an erection, the penis starts to suffer, and there can be loss of tissue, scarring. Well, because people think if it says herbal, it's safer. You know, it's safer, it's cheaper, it's easier to get. They need to be aware that frequently these products have not been tested, certainly not tested the way a drug is tested, but they haven't even been tested the way the FDA requires a dietary supplement to be tested.
The CDC's report says 65% of ER visits for supplement-related problems involved an herbal or complementary nutritional substance, but one LAER said the problem isn't as bad as it used to be.
We used to see that a lot, but about 10 years ago, you had to start advertising that if you're taking these supplements, you really do have to talk to your doctor to make sure that they don't interfere with your regular medicine. And I think it really helped because people don't come in anymore.
That's Mary Lou D'Alessio, director of the emergency room at Good Samaritan Hospital.
Very rarely. Sometimes somebody will come in with an allergic reaction and you'll find out they've been taking some kind of herb. But most of the time, we don't get anything.
Odom remains on life support in Las Vegas. Maria Cavasuto, Annenberg Radio News.
Today, California counties got an F on a report card. It's a decarceration report card issued by Californians United for Responsible Budget, or CURB. The group says California counties are failing to reduce their jail populations, and instead, they're expanding them. Since 2007, more than $2.2 billion have been put towards local jail construction. Mark Anthony Johnson is with Dignity and Power Now.
The popular narrative that's happening in Los Angeles County is that the jail population is going to continue to grow and the mental health population is going to continue to grow. The Sheriff's Department would have us believe that in order to meet the needs of this growing population, we need to build. However, these projections have been based on false projections.
Johnson says the emphasis should be on keeping people out of jail in the first place.
So what we are pushing for is a comprehensive mental health and diversion infrastructure to move $2 billion away from jail construction, but into permanent supportive housing, to treatment programs, to community-based alternatives.
Johnson says Black and Latinos are disproportionately represented in California jails. Advocates say these are the populations that need community-based alternatives. Lizzie Buchan of CURB says one reform that could be made is to the cash bail system.
Two-thirds of people in jails are awaiting trial.
And these are people who are legally innocent.
And for most of them, a judge has set bail.
Which means that the judge has determined that they are not a flight risk and are not a risk to the public.
So why are they in jail?
Because they cannot afford to post bail.
Buchan says there is also a troubling trend of jails being billed as mental health providers.
That is an oxymoron. Jails are violent, chaotic places. They forcibly remove people from their families and communities. They seclude them in locked facilities and deprive them of autonomy, of dignity, and of any sense of control.
Buchan says community-based mental health programs are more effective and more humane. But when the funding goes to the jails, community programs get cut. California has been under court order to reduce its prison population, but the Public Policy Institute of California says the state's prisons are still at 135.8% of capacity, down only 2% from 6 years ago. If you've ever wondered about the origins of curious words and phrases, here's Joe Salvato with today's Root Source.
In the past few years, one Halloween phenomenon always seems to keep people interested. Zombies. Yes, everyone's about zombies today, whether it's The Walking Dead or Fear the Walking Dead or Dawn of the Dead or Shaun of the Dead. Everybody wants to see the dead. The word's origins come from the West African language Kikongo, which has the word zumbi, meaning fetish, and zambi, meaning god. So originally, zombie didn't even involve death. It had to do with holiness. The first record of its use was an 1819 book by Robert Southey. He wrote that zombie is what the West Africans called a snake god that they worshipped. Then, when these people were enslaved and brought to Haiti in the 18th and 19th century, they brought these eerie customs with them, sparking the Haitian voodoo culture. It wasn't until later that the term zombie was used to refer to a dead person that can be revived by a sorcerer. From then on, the word took off with books and film and everything else to become the phenomenon it is today, no longer the fetish-ridden, heavenly word that it once was.
Annenberg Media reporters Max Schwartz and Rachel Scott were in the spin room at the first Democratic debate in Las Vegas early this week. Producer Martha Daniel talked to them about how it differed from the Republican showdown and which candidate they felt came on top.
The first question I have for you guys is just how the Democratic debate differed from the Republican debate last month.
I think, and we saw a lot of it in the types of questions that were asked. In this Democratic debate, rather than the Republican debate, we saw a broader range of issues asked. College affordability made its way in. Guns made its way in. We saw a lot of racial issues get talked about, and the candidates had time to answer that. The Republican debate, to me, was more of pitting the candidates against one another.
Exactly. I think obviously the main difference is that you actually talked about real issues here. You weren't talking about religion or one candidate or Second Amendment rights. And also the motive of Jake Tapper was to get the candidates against one another because they've been fighting each other the whole time, and that would make for good television. And here Anderson Cooper wanted to ask the questions that people deserve to know an answer to and that were real issues. And also there were a lot more people in the room, which I think also changed the atmosphere. And you could definitely tell that Bernie had the most applause out of anyone.
What moments surprised you during the debate?
Definitely when Sanders said, you know, Americans are sick and tired of hearing about those emails. And so rarely you see, you know, candidates that are running against each other get on the same side, especially when they could use that as a target and use it to bring down the other candidate. The Twitterverse just went crazy when that happened. And it really speaks to his character, I think, more so, which people were really happy to see.
Yeah, and I think that's going to have a large effect on voters. And
talk to me about the setup of the spin room. What does the behind the scenes of all of this look like?
Yeah, the behind the scenes was awesome. The spin room was really cool for this debate in particular, they had a Facebook lounge where you could see in real time kind of what the top five issues were that people were talking about, the top five candidates, both Republican and Democrat. You can click state by state to see, you know, who's talking about what, who's voting for what. I mean, it was just really interactive. And it was really CNN and Facebook's way of engaging social media. You know, a lot of these conversations do take place online. That was perhaps one of my favorite parts about the spin room, was that it was more innovative and more creative and definitely more social.
And I will say that I think that Rachel and I both agree that if the Republican debate in Simi Valley was our Disneyland, Las Vegas and the Democratic debate was our Disney World.
Definitely.
Who for you won the debate?
For me, it was Sanders all the way. I think Clinton did a really good job, but Sanders was someone I really hadn't really considered before as a really, you know, presentable and tough candidate against Hillary Clinton. And he was very honest, very direct in answering some of the bigger questions, choosing an answer rather than just going in that political circle we see candidates do so many times.
However, I do believe that it was a toss-up only because Hillary Clinton didn't hurt herself. But I think not only now is Bernie's attendance numbers reflective, but he's proven the fact that he's a legitimate candidate. He's not just spewing off a liberal wish list.
Rachel Scott and Max Schwartz, thank you so much for stopping by again. We really appreciate it, and we can't wait to see where you guys report from next.
Steve Sarkisian was fired as the head coach of the USC Trojan football team this week. Sound of Troy reporter Paolo Ughetti reflects on what can now be called a historically troubled football program.
When USC was sanctioned by the NCAA in 2010, everyone thought the program had reached its low point. The Trojans had to vacate Heisman trophies, bowl victories, and entire seasons because of rules violations that also caused scholarship reductions and postseason bans. When the team headed into the 2012 season atop the preseason polls, only to wind up with a 7-6 record and its coach unceremoniously fired halfway through the following year, USC became the punchline of jokes among other fan bases. When cornerback Josh Shaw attempted to cover up an injury in a police chase by fabricating a story about saving his drowning nephew from a swimming pool, a story their university believed and promoted, everyone thought surely then that we had hit rock bottom. When head coach Steve Sarkisian stood among boosters and team family members earlier this year at the annual Salute to Troy booster event intoxicated, slurring his words, using profanity, and verbally attacking opposing teams, everyone realized that there were lower depths still for the program to sink to. And now, with Sarkisian canned, USC football once again finds itself in the weed of controversy. Now, with reports surfacing of Sarkisian's extracurricular actions during both his season and his tenure at Washington, it's obvious that sooner or later, this was going to be the way things ended. But it's fair to ask, couldn't and shouldn't this have all ended sooner or even better been prevented? It's evident Sarkisian has a serious health problem. The fact that he's finally getting treatment is perhaps the only positive takeaway from this. Sarkisian's problem should not be equated with Trojan football or any other university politics, because it's much more serious than a silly game we all ravenously consume on Saturdays and Sundays. On the football side of things, it's safe to say that Sarkisian, for his part, did himself no favors by immediately touting championships and a win-now mentality upon returning to USC. What Carroll's program had that Sarkisian has lacked was sustained focus on the one true goal, winning. And if we have learned anything in the past few years, it's that winning trumps nearly anything and everything. Win, and people will forget about the Salute to Troy incident, everyone said. Win, and people will look the other way. Win, and none of this will matter. Winning is quite an effective, blinding light, and one could argue that this is why Hayden refused to put Sark on a leave of absence after Salute to Troy. The team had just been chosen by the media to finish atop the Pac-12, and there was an aura of heightened expectations that felt like they could be finally fulfilled. Placing this team under an interim coach in that moment would have threatened that budding potential. Instead, Hayden stood behind the man he hired and reiterated that he'd vetted Sark before bringing him back on in 2013. But would we be here now if the team were 4-0? There's no possible way that Hayden did not know of Sarkisian's past incidents with alcohol if he did in fact vet him before offering him the job. If Hayden was unaware of these things, then that points to an entirely different type of shortcoming altogether. With Sarkisian gone and the team now under yet another interim coach, Clay Helton, for the second time, uncertainty reigns again at University Park, and the ramifications of this low point are already being felt. Not long after Sarkisian's leave of absence was announced, 5-star linebacker Dalen Hayes took to Twitter to announce his decommitment from USC. The Trojans had already announced his commitment, and due to NCAA rules, it appears it may be looking at minor sanctions ahead. Yes, more sanctions. It all comes back full circle, doesn't it? The question is, when will this counterproductive cycle stop? Paul Ugetti, Annenberg Radio News.
USC Annenberg hosted a hackathon for women. Participant Megan Coyle shares her story.
Hackathons usually look like this. A bunch of guys dressed in jeans and t-shirts with logos of startups you've never heard of. But that wasn't at all what Annenberg looked like this past weekend when the school hosted the Hack the Gender Gap Hackathon. Here's how keynote speaker Nani de la Peña, also known as the godmother of virtual reality, described it.
Look at all these women here. It is like a miracle. You don't even know.
We laughed about the sad state of women in technology more than once over the course of the weekend. More than 60 girls from schools across the country was all it took to amaze our guest speakers. These girls came from computer science, journalism, and business backgrounds, and most of them knew almost nothing about the theme of our hackathon. But that didn't matter. Thousands of women write themselves off in the tech industry because they don't think they're qualified. But these girls were willing to challenge themselves. We were developing a business or a product related to virtual reality journalism all in one weekend. Somehow, everything and nothing that people say about women in tech came true during the hackathon. I saw some of those weaknesses about the way that women work. Some of my teammates would introduce their innovative idea, only to follow it up with a, "I don't know, it was just an idea, we can do whatever." My teammate, Shannon McGregor, a PhD student at the University of Texas at Austin, explained how the nature of a hackathon helps girls work through some of those confidence issues.
Sometimes when we think too long about something, we talk ourselves out of it. The speed of weekends like this forces you to just be bold with your ideas and have confidence in them, and I think that's the best way for things to move forward quickly, especially for women.
At the same time, I saw plenty of promise. I know it's not a lack of interest that keeps women out of the tech industry. Those girls put on a virtual reality headset and got hooked. It's just that sometimes they needed another voice to show their support. And at this hackathon, it was so refreshing to be able to hear your girlfriend's voice just outside the headset. Megan Coyle, Annenberg Radio News.
Two University of Southern California alums have made it to the big leagues. Kai Sato and Brenton Sullivan's company is one of 10 startups chosen by the Los Angeles Dodgers for their Business Accelerator program. Their company, Field Level, puts the world of college sports recruiting online. It connects high school and college coaches with each other and athletes with schools. Match Volume reporter Brian Bencomo spoke with Sato and Sullivan about how they came up with the idea for Field Level and the advantages of working with the Dodgers.
So I want to know a little bit about how Field Level started. I understand that it has its origins at USC, so I'm curious, how did the idea come about? How did you guys meet?
Kai and I actually have a long history together. We went to rival boarding schools. We met each other on the sports fields. Ultimately, we both showed up at SC and kind of joined forces there. Late junior year, we were talking about technology and YouTube and what it was doing to sort of sports. And during our discussions, what really came about was that recruitment could be a really interesting aspect of how technology was going to shift things. And the reason why it resonated with us was because we felt like we had both had this personal pain of going to these very small boarding schools that didn't really put any focus on helping athletes ascend to the next level of sports.
We wanted to go play college sports. We are not alone in that. There are millions of kids that want to figure out whether you're going to play at Cornell or USC or anything in between, Division III programs, things like that. It was just really complicated to get on the radar of college coaches. And you go to these events and there's all sorts of money that's spent oftentimes frivolously. So we recognize that technology could play a unique part, and Field Level is designed to level that recruiting field. So bringing college coaches and high school coaches together on a platform that was very different than Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn and some of the other social networks that we saw at the time, it was really tailored to solve this recruiting problem. And so to where we've arrived now, we are the biggest recruiting platform in collegiate baseball, football, lacrosse, men's basketball, and just launched soccer. And when we say that, we work with the vast majority of college programs. We also work with tens of thousands of high schools and then hundreds of thousands of athletes who are on our platform. And there's a lot more that goes into it, which we can elaborate on, than just stats and video, which are commonly thrown out in the recruiting world. But ultimately, bringing the necessary parties together is the secret sauce of making recruiting truly scale.
The reason why we created this platform was because it absolutely would have transformed our lives and given us better opportunities.
I know that you said that you're not technically a startup, you're not, you know, traditionally the type of company that would join an accelerator program. So what sort of advantages did you guys see in joining this program?
This program's first of its kind. Back to the standard model of accelerators, it's we have an idea, they help further us along, give us some office space, maybe a little bit of money, and then we build out an initial product, and then we raise even more money when it concludes. For us, it's very strategic. There are some very high level kind of opportunities in content, whether it's working with some of the big media companies, also on data. So social networks are all about their data, and we have years of it now, right? We've built this company over several years, and so we have some pretty unique insights that we're now kind of taking to the market. And true to its name, this program has helped accelerate that, making sure that we're meeting with the right people, getting great feedback, very similar to how we built the initial platform at Field Level. We're always doing a lot of customer discovery and talking to people before things go to market. But it's been pretty fascinating because, I mean, even one of the largest leagues, we won't say which one, they said, well, we were looking for a solution like you guys, and we tried to build it for years, and you guys have scaled this. So that's obviously really validating, and it was just a matter of getting in front of the right people. And so that's what's been so unique about this, because we might have 4 or 5 meetings a day right now with people that are potential partners, potential clients, all sorts of stuff. And so true to its name, it really has pushed some of those initiatives along.
In the southernmost point of LA County, a hidden city is tucked away in the seaside cliffs. It's called the Sunken City. Michael Radcliffe went to check it out.
When you get a tip to a place called Sunken City, it's hard to ignore. The name alone evokes mystery. It sounds like it should be on the bottom of the ocean floor, not in San Pedro. It's no Atlantis, but the Sunken City retains all of the excitement and the wonder that the name alludes. But in the southernmost point of LA County is where you'll find these mysterious ruins. Greeting you when you arrive is a no trespassing sign and a gate that stretches along a long dirt path behind a series of houses. From that angle, the Sunken City looks like nothing at all. Once inside the fence, the hidden cliffside opens up and reveals the secret city. Gray concrete foundations jut out of the earth and are crisscrossed by a web of paths.
Yeah, they call it Sunken City.
It's like people that draw, like there's art and stuff down here.
To outsiders, this place is all about the mystery. But to locals, this place is an escape. It's a way to relax, have some privacy, like a post-apocalyptic beach resort.
So it's like I've seen people that were camping out over here for like a week or so, you know, just bike riding just all day, every morning.
Every single inch of the exposed foundation was covered in graffiti-style art.
I'm here to paint the world a beautiful place. That's about it.
I came across one guy who wore a solid silver mask to hide his identity, as well as muffle his voice.
I used to be a graffiti artist, then I became a painter, and I'm a tattoo artist. And I'm just enjoying the beach.
He was overseeing another who was doing his own work.
Learning on his own. We all have to learn our own style. Probably lasts, if you do a good one, probably lasts a little longer, a couple of weeks. Or I might just...
He said it was much safer out here than painting in the streets, that he didn't have to worry about the cops. I met Virgil at a bar, just on the other side of the fence.
You know more about Sunken City than I do.
Well, the way Sunken City happened was back in the 30s, there was an earthquake. It kind of just fell off into the sea.
But the area isn't without its dangers. There have been talks about opening the Sunken City to the public, with a gate that closes automatically at sundown. No matter the case, the people here will still find a way to experience this refuge tucked into the cliffside, taking in all that it offers, as long as you're willing to climb a bit. For Unseen LA, I'm Michael Radcliffe, Annenberg Radio News.
That's it from where we are. For all of us here at Annenberg Radio News, I'm Carla Javier.